Blog Talk Radio.
Radio, and welcome to the show. We've got a really exciting list of guests for you tonight, but first I just want to say we're in the mountains of beautiful British Columbia tonight, having dinner with my family for my birthday, and we're watching the Toronto Blue Jays and the San Francisco, what's their name? The San Francisco Giants. And Toronto's winning 2-0, so we'll keep an eye on that game for you tonight. It's just incredible the guests we have tonight. We've got Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch. He will be speaking for about half an hour. It's a pre-taped interview. We've also got Dr. Martin Sherman again from the columnist for the Jerusalem Post. We'll be discussing his last couple of articles. And I've also got Mika Danzig from, he's a lawyer who lives in California. He's a former IDF soldier and a blogger for the Times of Israel. I'll be giving his bio a little bit later as well. But first, I do want to make a couple of comments about what happened yesterday, or actually it was this morning. there were two. There was a stabbing in Germany by a jihadist who went into a crowded commuter train in Munich and started screaming "Aloha snack bar" or whatever it is that they say when they start stabbing innocent civilians in the street. And he also said that the infidels must die. And then Reuters had the gall to report that this had nothing to do with Islam. So here we go with the gaslighting, my friends, and the lying and obfuscation that this has nothing to do with Islam, even though, so what does a jihadist have to do these days to get recognized for what he does? And there were two brave global jihadists in Israel stabbed two 80-year-old ladies in Jerusalem. So there you go. So in my opinion, this global jihad needs to be crushed. But when are our leaders going to do that? That's the question. And I did discuss this with Robert Spencer in the interview. So stay tuned, and I will be playing that interview right now. We did discuss he visited Calgary, Alberta, and was actually smeared in our leftist liberal media. They treated him very badly. So I was quite embarrassed about that, being a Canadian myself. So here I'm going to play Robert's interview now, and hopefully you'll enjoy it. And we'll talk to you. We'll see you at the end of this when we play Dr. Martin Sherman's interview. So hold on, I'll play it right now. This is Leslie Ann Stoffel, and I have a very special guest today. His name is Robert Spencer. I'm a huge fan of Robert Spencer. Anyway, I'll get into all that. But he's the director of Jihad Watch, a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and the author of 15 books, including the New York Times bestsellers, The Truth About Muhammad and the Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. His latest book is The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS, which I'm actually reading right now. I couldn't finish it in time here, but I am reading it. Coming in July 2016 will be The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. Mr. Spencer has led seminars on Islam and jihad for the FBI, the United States Central Command, United States Army Command, and General Staff College, the U.S. Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group, and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and the U.S. Intelligence Community. He has discussed jihad, Islam, and terrorism at a workshop sponsored by the U.S. State Department and the German Foreign Ministry. He has served as a contributing writer to Stephen Emerson's Investigative Project on Terrorism and as an adjunct fellow with the Free Congress Foundation. There's a lot more of his biography on his website. This is Leslie Ann Stoffel, and I have a very special guest today. His name is Robert Spencer. I'm a huge fan of Robert Spencer. Anyway, I'll get into all that. But he's the director of Jihad Watch, a program of the David Horowitz Freedom Center, and the author of 15 books, including the New York Times bestsellers, The Truth About Muhammad and the Politically Incorrect Guide to Islam and the Crusades. His latest book is The Complete Infidel's Guide to ISIS, which I'm actually reading right now. I couldn't finish it in time here, but I am reading it. Coming in July 2016 will be The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran. Mr. Spencer has led seminars on Islam and jihad for the FBI, the United States Central Command, United States Army Command, and General Staff College, the U.S. Army's Asymmetric Warfare Group, and the Joint Terrorism Task Force, and the U.S. Intelligence Community. Discussed jihad, Islam, and terrorism at a workshop sponsored by the U.S. State Department and the German Foreign Ministry. He has served as a contributing writer to Stephen Emerson's Investigative Project on Terrorism and as an adjunct fellow with the Free Congress Foundation. There's a lot more of his biography on his website, Jihad Watch. So I encourage everybody to go there and look at that. So thank you, Mr. Spencer, for coming on the show. I am a huge fan of you and Pamela Geller. I post your guys' articles like every day and keep up I'm a Canadian. I'm here in Vancouver, and I'm extremely concerned now about what's going on. I've been watching the jihad in Israel, and now it's coming here to Canada because we have a new Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, who's very, very sympathetic to the Islamic cause and is doing everything within his power to Islamicize Canada, basically, is my in my estimation. So Robert was here, Mr. Spencer was here, I guess it was last week, speaking in Calgary. Now, I didn't get to go. I did watch the video of the talk, and that's what I'm going to ask questions about. But first of all, Robert, Mr. Spencer, you were slandered in our press, at the CBC. Well, they called you an anti-Islamist, and they did. Can you talk about that a little bit, and then talk about this debate that you were you wanted to have a debate with an imam from Canada here? So just tell us about what happened with that. Disturbing.
Sure. The CBC headline said I was anti-Muslim, and that's, of course, something that's very commonly charged, when it's really more revealing of the people who make the charge than it is of those against whom they level it. The fact is that to think that it's anti-Muslim to oppose jihad terror, the mass murder of innocent civilians, the explosions, the bombings, as well as the stonings and amputations and all the rest of it, if that's anti-Muslim to oppose that, then it gives a lie to their claim that Muslims all reject jihad terror and that it has nothing to do with Islam. They can have it both ways, and yet they try. They claim that none of those things have anything to do with Islam, but if you oppose them, you're anti-Muslim. It's no more true that I am anti-Muslim than to oppose Nazism during World War II was to be anti-German. It's simply opposition to a violent, supremacist, authoritarian ideology that is seeking to impose itself all around the world. And so this was, of course, the coverage that went before the talk and after. But those who came and saw, or those who've seen the video, they know that the situation is very different. And actually, what I'm saying has nothing to do with hate at all or being anti anyone. And as far as the imam goes, that's the imam Syed Sohar Hardy of Calgary. And he is notorious for taking Ezra Levant to court for publishing the cartoons of Muhammad, which is something that's against Islamic law to do, but it's not against Canadian law or any kind of law that's in the West to do. And so this is already somebody who's an opponent of the freedom of speech and has numerous other unsavory aspects to his record. When I spoke in Calgary, he denounced me, and then he wrote on his Facebook page that he was challenging this hate monger, which is me, of course, in his view, to a debate. I was alerted to this by some people who saw his Facebook page, and so I agreed to the debate. But then he insisted that the debate be moderated and hosted by organizations that had denounced me along with him when I spoke in Calgary. So it was clear that what he wanted was not an honest and open discussion of the salient issues, but essentially a Stalinist show trial in which I would be denounced and hectored and harassed by not only the my opponent in the debate, which would have been him, but by the moderator and by the audience as well. I'm perfectly happy to debate anyone on a level playing field, but not when it's something that's so obviously stacked. And when it was clear that I wasn't going to accept that, then the imam stalked away after having retailed numerous other slanders in his email.
Yes, yeah, that was just so. The whole thing is so Orwellian to me. It's becoming so alarming with these sort of people being able to shove their agenda down everybody's throats and slander somebody like you. It's very, very disappointing to me, and I feel very embarrassed actually when we have a guest to the country and then they do that. But anyway, I just want to go on with my questions here. Can you tell the audience, how did you get into the work of studying and writing about Islam?
This was something that came out of my own family's experience. My grandparents were from the Islamic world. They were born and grew up in the Ottoman Empire, the last great caliphate, the last caliphate in the Islamic world before, of course, the Islamic State or ISIS. And they they were exiled in 1918 for declining to convert to Islam. And I knew them when they were old and was interested in what had happened over there, because they always spoke about it in a very positive way, spoke about how wonderful it was there. And I was thinking, well, if it was so great, then why did you get exiled? Which is something they either could not or would not explain to me. So I started to study it on my own and began to figure out what was going on, that what was going on had, what had happened had everything to do with Islam. And this led me into the study of Islam, which is ongoing.
Wow, that's really interesting how that all came about. Now, you don't have to get too personal or anything, but I just wonder about this, especially in light of what just happened with this imam and myself, now that I've become more and more involved with this because of the necessity of, I see our Western civilization hanging on the precipice here, and I feel the need to speak out. What do you do to break from the heaviness and the darkness of this work and the attacks that are so unfair and untrue that come against you? And it's also sort of a spiritual and a psychic attack. And also like dealing with all this death and gore all the time. How do you, I know you're optimistic because you always say we've got truth on our side. Truth wins out. Life wins out, not death. So how do you keep that optimism going?
Well, that's something that I think it's wise to remind oneself of on a regular basis, and to try to keep a perspective about these things, to remember that it's really very easy to tell the truth, and there's nothing to it. You don't have to remember anything. It's right there. It's the truth. It's reality. And so I don't have nearly as hard a job as those who are trying to defend jihad terror and to expand the idea of the bogus idea of Islamophobia or something of that kind in the United States, because they have to lie all the time. And with me, it's easy. I don't have that good a memory to be a liar.
That's right. Me too. Okay, now, as I've said, I'm very alarmed at Justin Trudeau's blind support for Islam and the fact that he's planned to bring in thousands of these so-called migrants. Now, I'm going to get in a little bit later to you for you to explain the Hijra, because you did explain that. It's very important. You explained it in the video. But anyway, these migrants, why would a Western leader assist in the destruction of his country, of his civilization? And do you think we'll be able to hold these leaders accountable at the end of all this, say, as the Nazis were held accountable? I mean, I know that sounds a bit odd, but it's something in my mind I'm thinking about.
I don't think it's odd at all. I think you're quite right that what they're doing to our nations is just as severe as what the Nazis did to Germany and did to Europe. And so the idea that these leaders should be held accountable, I think, is all to the good, and I hope it expands. I think what they're thinking, what Trudeau and Barack Obama, David Cameron, Manuel Valls and François Hollande in France and all the rest of them, and especially, of course, Angela Merkel in Germany, they all think that they're all Marxist internationalists who think, well, I don't know that Cameron is a Marxist, but the rest of them are certainly Marxist internationalists, and Cameron's going along. And in any case, they believe that the problem in the world is that the United States is a superpower, and there's this inequality in the world, economic, military, political inequality. And so if America were drastically weakened politically, militarily, and economically, then the world will be equal. And this is what socialists strive for, is for equality of outcome, equality from each according to his ability, to each according to his needs, so that nobody is wealthier or more powerful than anyone else.
Right.
This is the utopian worldview that they have, and they're trying to bring it about by destroying international distinctions, destroying borders, and making it impossible to defend a country, because the one's country and culture is under assault from within and can't be fought in the country.
Right. Now, you've just sort of answered my next question, because I'm saying in the talk you did in Calgary, you explained how indeed IS is indeed Islamic. The Islamic State is indeed Islamic. Duh. Unlike what our Prime Minister and all the other Western leaders are telling us. How did every single Western leader all of a sudden become Islamist apologists and gaslight and lie for them? So you basically just answered it, because I'm also saying, are they being paid off as well? It just seems so odd.
I wouldn't be surprised. I don't know. But look, I do know this. If you look at a list of paid lobbyists for the Saudi regime in Washington and compare it to a list of former U.S. diplomats who served in Saudi Arabia, there's quite a lot of overlap. Now, that is no coincidence. They were paid by the Saudis to become lobbyists, which is completely legal, after they had retired from the U.S. government. Fair enough. But if the Saudis are buying lobbyists, then what's to prevent them from trying to buy other kinds of influence? And I think it's clear that that what's going on in Washington has a great deal to do with the influence that they wield, and that it's a direct willful blindness about the threat of jihad and Islam, and the lying to the American people consistently about it, as if Barack Obama and all the other Western leaders seem to think that their primary responsibility after any terror attack is to cover for Islam and make sure that nobody thinks ill of Islam. It's appalling, but it does make me think, well, what could possibly be in it for them? And I do think I'd like to see, I hope someday, a searching and honest investigation of just how extensive Saudi influence in Washington really is.
Yes, because they just all seem way too gleeful and quick to jump to the microphone and try to discredit and say the Islamic State has nothing to do with Islam. I mean, this, I don't know, I just feel like peeling myself off the ceiling when I hear it, because it's just so absurd and dangerous. The next thing, now you explained this so well. Okay, I've heard you say this like 3 or 4 times in different videos and things, but it didn't sink in. It did sink in this time. You explained the Hijra, and that it is actually, I don't know if I'm saying this right, a doctrinal form within Islam. Like this invasion / Hijra is actually commanded within Islam for them to go to heaven. You can explain it, but it also juxtapose that this doctrinal command with the fact that the Islamic State has said they are going to send soldiers within this population of people. Please explain this to us.
Chapter 4, verse 100 of the Quran says that Allah is bound, it's incumbent upon him to reward those who emigrate for the sake of Allah. That is, those who leave their countries and go to another country in order to Islamize it. One can't just go to the other country in order to get a good job or something like that. It has to be for the purpose of Islamization. And then the reward is incumbent upon Allah. And so for a lot of these immigrants, and there have even been videos that show them saying this, they're coming to Europe and coming to Canada and the United States in order to bring Islam and thereby save their souls or gain a tremendous good deed that will get them access to paradise, or they hope it will get them closer to paradise. And so for them, it's a spiritual act, and it's one that has enormous implications for us, because they're not coming as refugees or people who are grateful and are willing to accept our own culture and mores. They're coming as conquerors and colonists, colonizers, to bring Islam to the West. And so Islam being not just a religion, but an authoritarian political and social system that's supremacist, misogynist, anti-Semitic, and so on, this is something that should be a matter of great concern to politicians, but instead they're all assuring us that Islam is wonderful.
Yes, yeah, exactly. This is so, so important for people to understand. It just really hit me the other night when I was watching that video. I'm going to interject a little personal story here, and then I'll go on to the jizya situation. I live in a suburb of Vancouver, and I haven't seen it, but my mom said she has seen men now walking around our town with their long gowns on, their Islamic gowns and their hats. And from my estimation, those are devout Muslims. And that's very, very concerning and alarming to me. This is like a small Canadiana, you know, little village on, like, I don't know, this is just, I don't want to live in the Middle East, but in a Middle Eastern country, and it looks like I'm being forced to here anyhow. Also, a couple of years ago, I was driving down one of the roads nearby, one of the places I was working out there in a 5 miles away or something. I saw this huge mosque and a compound, huge, and it was brand new. And I looked over there and I thought, what is that? That's a what's it doing there? We don't have enough Muslims here to fill that mosque. What's going on? All of a sudden, it came into my mind. I'm telling you, it came into my mind. It's waiting for something. And sure enough, it was, Mr. Spencer. Okay?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. So here, this is it. This is the Hijra coming. I can't believe what I'm seeing.
Well, you know, all these mosques are going up all over Canada, all over the United States. Huge mosques that are much larger than the population of Muslims in the area. And
yeah,
it's clear that they're designed to make a statement. They're designed to say to non-Muslims, we're here to stay. We're a massive presence. We're a growing presence. And
yes,
so we're going to be you're going to be seeing much more of us. And also,
yeah,
they are staking out for the future, that they plan to expand a tremendous degree. And so, if these mosques are essentially empty right now, they won't
mm-hmm.
be for long. And pretty soon they'll be packed.
Right. Exactly. And another thing I've heard you say, I believe you've quoted it from the Quran and said that if a Muslim comes here and he puts his foot down in this town, he believes that he owns this town. Like, I am now considered an interloper here in their mind.
Well,
is that correct?
Well, it's not quite that bad, but it's close. Any land that was ruled by Muslims at one time is considered in Islamic theology to belong to Islam forever. And so this
mm-hmm.
is the ultimate reason why Israel will never be acceptable to the Palestinians. It's not about land.
Right.
It's not about occupation. It's not about settlements. It's really that the state of Israel exists on land that was once ruled by Muslims. And
right.
so it belongs by right to Muslims forever. This is in the
mm-hmm.
Quran, where it says in chapter 2, verse 191, drive them out from where they drove you out. And in the view of the Muslim Arabs around Israel, of course, they claim that the Israelis drove them out of Israel, and so they have the responsibility before Allah to drive out the Israelis.
Yeah, yeah, okay. That's, yes, exactly. I've also heard you say that. That's very good to know. Now, the jizya is, can you explain the jizya? And are our welfare and social benefits being used to pay for our own demise through this?
Yes, the jizya is a tax that is specified in the Quran for the non-Muslims who are subservient under the rule of the Muslims. The idea is that Muslims must fight against non-Muslims, specifically Jews and Christians, and subjugate them under the rule of Islamic law. And the whole,
mm-hmm.
the key element of this subjugation, but not the only one, is that they pay this tax, the jizya, that the Muslims
mm-hmm.
don't have to pay. And it's a sign of their subservience and submission. And so it's considered by right that the non-Muslim wealth belongs to the Muslims. And this is Islamic theology based on the Quran. And so when we bring over these migrants and then allow them immediately to go on welfare, they are considering, many of them, that this is just what they are due, because the non-Muslims owe them upkeep. They owe them their livelihood. That it's the non-Muslims' responsibility to support the Muslims. And so this is their due, and this is why there's so many Muslim immigrants in Europe who are immediately going on the dole.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, it's really going to affect us here in Canada too. I can see that it's that the weight of this is going to be crushing, and all hell is going to break loose. I can just see it coming. It's just a nightmare anyway. Now, I hope you have time. I would like you to explain, if people don't understand, what this caliphate is, where is it at this point, and do they want to spread this worldwide?
The Islamic State claims to be the caliphate. That is the group that's known as ISIS or ISIL, and calls itself the Islamic State. They claim to be the caliphate. The caliphate is, in Islamic theology for Sunni Muslims, which is 85 to 90% of Muslims worldwide, the caliphate is the only legitimate government to which any Muslim owes allegiance. The word khilafa means successor, and the caliph is the successor of Muhammad as the political, military, and spiritual leader of the Muslims. There hasn't been a caliph since 1924, when the Ottoman Empire had fallen and the secular Turkish government abolished the caliphate in an attempt to limit the power of political Islam. Since then, there's been an attempt to restore the caliphate on the part of the jihad groups around the world. That's been one of the main things that they wanted to do. And now this Islamic State group has actually done it.
And the leader there, I remember seeing him standing up on the podium in the mosque, and I found that quite a sort of a turning point too with this. And he calls himself Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, is that right? And this name has significance. What is it?
Abu Bakr was one of Muhammad's closest companions, and he was the first caliph, the first successor of Muhammad in the year 632 when Muhammad died. And so the idea of his taking the name Abu Bakr is to associate himself with the caliphate and with Muhammad himself, and to claim as if he too, like the first Abu Bakr, is the successor of Muhammad.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, he was a really kind of a scary looking dude. And going on from there, I saw the 60 Minutes thing last night they had about the Yazidis being raped, being held a sex slave, being murdered. There were it's a genocide going on there. And I want to, now it's to only focus on the rape and sex slave is doing them a disservice. But I want to ask you, is this, when we see these rapes going on around England and around Europe, and they've even had some here in Canada, is this part of the jihad?
Yes, it is. The Quran says in four places, chapters 4 verse 3, 4 verse 24, 23 verses 1 to 6, 33 verse 50, and 70-30, that's actually five places, that Muslim men can have these captives of the right hand. And the captives of the right hand, those passages make very clear, are non-Muslim women who've been captured and are made into sex slaves. So this is something that's sanctioned by the Quran itself. Muhammad himself practiced this. And so when ISIS does it, when Boko Haram does it, this is something that they're just doing following the Quran. And this is one of the reasons why it's so difficult to counter their appeal, because Muslims look at what they do, and instead of being repulsed, they see, oh, they're following the Quran. This is indication that they really are the caliphate. And this is one of the reasons why the Islamic State has gained 30,000 Muslims from around the world joining.
Yes, yeah. It's a real welcome mat for all these guys that want to commit all these atrocities. Oh, it's just unbelievable. And you mentioned in the talk in Calgary that people are mistaken if they think by defeating the Islamic State, then our problems will be over. This is the same erroneous thinking that we heard about Al-Qaeda over. But I've been watching the global jihad now for years, watching your work and Pamela Geller's work and others, and seeing how it's manifested in many different ways. And of course, one way we've seen in Israel for years and years. And it won't be defeated by the demise of the Islamic State. And you say that they're fighting us now more because we are weak. How can we fight this? How can we defeat this global jihad?
In the first place, we have to recover our own cultural confidence. The United States went into Iraq and Afghanistan and overthrew the regimes there and installed Sharia regimes, Sharia constitutions that enshrined Islamic law as the highest law of the land. This would have been like going into Germany and toppling Hitler and then putting Himmler in his place. Mm-hmm. It doesn't change the situation because the Sharia Islamic law is what gives the basis for the principles on which the jihad is being fought. And so
right.
we have to confront the ideology, and we can only do that if we have confidence in ourselves, confidence in our principles of freedom as being superior to the principles of Islam and Sharia. And, well, that's nowhere on the horizon nowadays, but that would be how we would win.
Yeah, yeah. And I also see a big mistake that we're making in the West, which is to treat these attacks are being treated as police issues. So they
yeah,
can get
they don't
lawyers.
Want to admit there's a war.
So they can get lawyers. Then it's like then they know there's a jihadi around, but they can't get him because he hasn't hurt anybody or killed anybody yet. Oh my gosh, Robert, it's just like being in an insane asylum. But anyhow,
yes,
yeah,
it is.
Yeah, it's just crazy. So now the next thing, we're almost to the end of the questions here, but I want to ask you one more thing. This thing about, this was asked of you in the, I think in the video. How does the UN aid the jihad today? And how are they conspiring to stifle free speech in the West? Yeah, that.
The UN is essentially a servant of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, 57 Muslim governments worldwide, and it's the largest voting bloc at the UN, so essentially it can do whatever it wants. And what it mm-hmm. wants to do is limit the freedom of speech. For years, it's been passing resolutions calling upon member nations to criminalize incitement to religious hatred, which is an entirely subjective judgment, and even worse, when these vague terms like incitement to religious hatred are defined, then they are defined in a way to include counterterror investigations of the motives and goals of the terrorists. And so what they're really trying to do, what the OIC is trying to do through the UN, is criminalize any criticism of Islam and thereby leave the field open for the jihad to advance unopposed. And
yes.
No American politician seems to be aware of or anything but indifferent to this.
And again, it's just Orwellian. I was just going to say one more thing here. People get confused. I want you to just explain a little bit about the difference between the Sharia law, because they say, people say, well, what's wrong with that? It's just their Islamic Sharia law. It's the same as a Jewish law or a Catholic law or something like that. But it's really not.
No, it isn't. Sharia claims authority over non-Muslims, and it has directions for how non-Muslims are to be treated. The tax is just one aspect, and then the various mm-hmm. other humiliating and discriminatory regulations. And so the idea that it's the same as Jewish law, which makes no claim for authority over non-Jews, or Catholic canon law, which makes no claim of authority over non-Catholics, is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Sharia is political and supremacist, whereas the Jewish law and Catholic canon law are entirely private things that have to do with matters like marriage and so on, marriage and family life and so on, not having to do with the way the political system ought to be structured, or with the way that non-Muslims have to be treated, non-believers have to be treated. So
yeah.
The idea that they're the same is just a disingenuous claim designed to confuse people and make them complacent about the advance of Sharia in the West.
Right. And it does cause cognitive dissonance in people because they're seeing one thing with their eyes and then they're being lied to their face by these so-called leaders. So it causes people to be confused and to have murky thinking and not be able to think clearly on these issues. So just to finish it off, Mr. Spencer, what can somebody, like, I'm just an average person out here, you know, very worried and concerned and wanting to do stuff. What could somebody like me and other people, my friends, people that listen, what can we do as just average people about this?
Well, you're doing it. You are doing it right now. The main thing that we all need to do is raise awareness. There's an incredible amount of disinformation and misinformation in regard to this issue. And so the main thing we need to do is tell the truth, tell it everywhere we can, tell it without trimming, and keep on telling it no matter what the consequences may be.
Okay. Okay, that's a very, very good little push to get us going again with the optimistic ending to everything, and we will keep doing that. And so I've come to the end of all of my questions pretty much because we answered everything. Do you have anything else you'd like to say?
I appreciate you being willing to talk about these difficult issues, and I hope more people will imitate you in that regard.
Well, thank you, Mr. Spencer. And again, I was able to contain my starstruckness here.
You're very kind.
And talk to one of my heroes of all time. So thank you so very much for coming on. And this will play tomorrow night, but if you'll probably be asleep or working or something. So there'll be a podcast, so I'll send that to you. And thank you so much, Robert. Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure. Have a good evening.
Okay. 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 Bye-bye. everybody. Welcome to the show. Welcome back to the show. It's Leslie Ann Stoffel with Real Clear Israel Radio. And I have, again, my good friend, Dr. Martin Sherman, as a guest. He's a prolific writer and all-around expert on what's going on in Israel and the difficulties and solutions. He has solutions for us, too, not just addressing problems. So Dr. Martin Sherman served for 7 years in operational capacities in the Israeli Defense Establishment. He was a ministerial advisor to Yitzhak Shamir's government and lectured for 20 years at Tel Aviv University in political science, international relations, and strategic studies. He holds several university degrees, a Bachelor of Science in Physics and Geology, an MBA in Finance, and a PhD in Political Science and International Relations. He was the first academic director of the internationally renowned Herzliya Conference and is the author of 2 books and numerous articles and policy papers on a wide range of political, diplomatic, and security issues. Currently, he writes a weekly column in the Jerusalem Post, and he also writes for Israel Hayom, both out of Israel, and we'll be discussing 2 of his Jerusalem Post articles today. He was born in South Africa and has lived in Israel since 1971. Dr. Martin Sherman, his website is martinsherman.net, and he is the founder and executive director of the Israel Institute for Strategic Studies at strategicisrael.org. I'll have those in the show notes for everybody too. So now the first article, welcome to the show, Dr. Martin Sherman. It's great to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back.
Can I just You're welcome.
Can I just correct one detail? The website is martinsherman.org.
Oh, .org. Okay. I must have gotten an old link. Okay, .org. I will change that in the show notes for everybody. Okay. Now, Dr. Martin Sherman, it's so great to talk to you again. I'm telling you, like I always say, it's like a lesson in political science, which is it's like sometimes it freezes my brain up, but hey, it's a good thing. Because, oh, wow, all this info, it's so great. So the first article that I want to talk about is it's called A Very Simple Conflict, and you go on to describe how it's been made into a convoluted, you know, difficult situation, but in actual fact, in a lot of ways, it's very simple. And I just want to read the first couple of things you've written here, the first couple of sentences. The intractability of the 100-year dispute between Jew and Arab over the land of Israel is rooted not in its complexity, but in its brutal simplicity. And then you go on to say, until 1967, Israel did not hold an inch of the Sinai Peninsula and the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, or the Golan Heights. Israel held not an acre of what is now considered disputed territory, and yet we enjoyed no peace. Year after year, Israel called for, pleaded for, a negotiated peace with the Arab governments. Their answer was a blank refusal and more war. The reason was not a conflict over territorial claims. The reason was and remains the fact that a free Jewish state sits on territory at all. And that appears to be Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin before a joint session of Congress in January 28, 1976.
Mm-hmm, that's correct.
So, yeah. So could you just kind of jump off from there as to what you were explaining in this, and then we'll go on from there.
Well, as you hinted in your preceding sentences, the conflict is often portrayed as a very complicated and complex conflict. But at the basis, at the bedrock of the conflict, is very, very simple. And it's not the complications and the complexity that make it difficult to find a solution, but the brutal simplicity, because it's basically a Zemois situation, a real zero-sum game, where the gains of one side are the losses of the other side. And it's rooted in the implacable rejection by the Arabs of anything with Jewish sovereignty. it's not a conflict that is about borders. It's not a conflict that's about policy. It's a conflict about what the Jews are and not what the Jews do. It's a conflict mm-hmm. about the Jewish state per se and not about the policy of the Jewish state.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
unless you can come to terms and face that reality squarely, you will never find a solution. You'll be pussyfooting around this problematic situation and finding stopgap proposals which will not solve the problem, but merely perpetuate it. And unfortunately, during the time that the conflict is being perpetuated, Israel's superiority, I think, is being eroded. You know, people may find it a bit strange because we do have clear technological and military superiority at the moment. But the problem, the real danger that Israel is facing today, are not problems of an Arab invasion. It's a problem of ongoing attrition and ongoing delegitimization of the country. We saw some of this in the last Gaza conflict, where settlements in the south were actually evacuated, and because of the ongoing attrition of the population there, and until they were quite sure that the fighting had stopped, many civilians wouldn't return to their homes. Now, if this happens in more populated areas, closer to the center of the country, the ramifications could be extremely serious, both for society and for the economy.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, because of the ongoing delegitimization of Israel and the refusal to face the fact that the conflict is basically rooted in Arab rejection of any kind of Jewish self-determination on any territory whatsoever, Israel has gradually accepted more and more of the adversary's narrative and being pushed back further and further and further. And until the situation, I fear, may become untenable. You know, I've said a few times, taking the Israeli leadership to task, is that they have a policy of trying to avoid confrontations in which Israel could win, until they find themselves backed into a confrontation in which Israel cannot win.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Yeah, it you go on to say down here, you know, going with that theme, you have a heading here, recognition, really, as an un-Jewish state, how accommodating. And this was something that Abbas had said. Let's see here. It says, no slip of the tongue. Several months earlier, in Reuters reported on March the 9th, the Arab League has backed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's rejection of Israel as a Jewish state and endorsed Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas's rejection of Israel's demand for recognition as a Jewish state. The League issued a statement declaring the Council of the Arab League confirms Palestinian leadership and emphasizes its rejection of recognizing Israel as a Jewish state. Clearly, this should be a sobering message for all self-professed Zionists who have so eagerly advocated that Israel adopt the Arab League plan, a.k.a. the Saudi initiative, which calls for a return to the indefensible pre-1967 lines, division of Jerusalem, return of Arab refugees, and withdrawal from the Golan Heights as a basis for a peace negotiations and pan-Arab recognition. So this is where you say, recognition for an un-Jewish state, how accommodating, and you say the resolute rejection of Jewish sovereignty, which increasingly has reflected itself in expression of revulsion at things Jewish, should be seen as a backdrop to some recently reported and revealing insights. And this is the one, the part about, tell us about the, where Abbas called the, didn't want the Jewish filthy feet on the Temple Mount, and then the Jordanian warning about their proposal, they recanted on having security cameras on the Temple Mount. And then the attack on Ziffy Livni, those are three different things you've got listed here. And can you kind of, you know, describe to the audience what is going on behind this? You've called it the bitter fruits. So
bitter fruits of pliancy, I call it, was particularly focused on the incident with Ziffy Livni at Harvard, where a student of Palestinian origin, I believe, from the Justice for Palestine movement at Harvard, stood up and wanted to ask a question. And his question was, you know, why Ziffy Livni has such a bad odor. Now, people were taken aback by this, and they asked him to repeat his question. No one really knew what he was saying, and it wasn't a slip of the tongue, because he said, you know, I was asking about your odor. Why are you so smelly? Which has clear anti-Semitic connotations, you know, reminiscent of the smelly Jew. Now, in the case of Ziffy Livni, I think this illustrates precisely what I said before about not being what the Jews do, but what the Jews are. Because Ziffy Livni has been extremely pliant in being accepting of Palestinian demands and being very receptive to many of their claims. But this didn't really help her in her encounter with this young man. And she was denigrated as a smelly Jew because she was Jewish, not because of being pliant towards the Palestinians. And, you know, this is reminiscent of what Abbas said about the Jews desecrating the holy places with their filthy feet. You can just imagine what would happen if an Israeli politician had expressed himself the same way about the Arabs or the Palestinians or the Muslims. And the world would be aghast, and protests would be engulfing capitals and campuses, etc., etc.
Yes, absolutely.
So I think this illustrates the fact that the revulsion is not against Zionist policy, but against Jewish sovereignty and all things Jewish per se. Now, if you look at the Arab peace plan, so-called peace plan, basically it's a formula for stage one of the obliteration of the Jewish state. And when I say the refusal to recognize Israel as a Jewish state is not tactical. Tactical. It's strategic. It's not tactical posturing. It's strategic positioning, because that keeps alive the claim for the right of return. Because if Israel is not recognized as a Jewish state, the Palestinians or the Arabs still have a viable claim for the right of return, which today would involve something like 5 million Palestinian or former Palestinian Arabs returning into the pre-67 borders or any similar borders that would be agreed upon on some envisioned peace agreement. And, of course, this would make Israel completely untenable demographically as the nation state of the Jewish people. So, you know, I find it very, very strange that so many of the Israeli elites seem amenable to the Saudi peace plan, because basically it has four elements, which most Zionist parties reject anyway. The one is the relinquishing of the Golan Heights, which has been put in cold storage for a while, but as you know, recently it was resurrected and put back to the headlines. The next thing is the division of Jerusalem, which most Zionist parties disagree with, and it would mean relinquishing the heart of Jewish symbolism and Jewish sites and Jewish heritage. The next thing is the return to the indefensible 67 borders, which I think today especially if you imagine that the regime in Jordan may not be stable, to withdraw to the 67 borders and have a hostile regime taking over in Jordan and interfacing with a hostile Palestinian regime on the very approaches of Israel's most populated area would be crazy. And then you have the issue of the right of return, which is part of the Arab initiative. And this, of course, again, as we said before, would involve engulfing Israel in a huge wave of Palestinian Arabs, which would totally make any possibility of a Jewish nation state untenable.
Yes. Dr. Sherman, can you explain to the audience the Palestinian UNRWA situation? These so-called refugees were put in a special category, and they've been allowed to multiply over years and years and years. They've been kept in camps, and they've been multiplying and multiplying. And this is the most the oddest refugee situation, I think, in the entire world, because there were like a million Jewish refugees in 1948 thereabouts, and yet they were all absorbed into Israel. They were ejected from Arab lands. Now these refugees are bogus, and they're another cog in the wheel to destroy Israel. They've been building a building for years in order to, hopefully, what they would like is to bring them all in and destroy the state demographically that way. So can you explain the oddity of these so-called refugees and how they've come about? Because this is a completely strange situation. As in most refugee situations, refugees are they try to find homes for them, and they're eventually, you know, they don't live in camps for 40, 50, 60 years.
Yeah, well, you're quite right. All the refugees on the face of the globe, whether it's from famine or earthquakes or tsunamis or political persecution, under the auspices of an organization called the UN High Commission for Refugees, except the Palestinians. The Palestinians have a separate organization called UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, which deals only with Palestinian refugees, and only Palestinian refugees involved in the conflict with Israel, by the way. Palestinian refugees who were ejected from Iraq in the Gulf War were dealt with by UNRWA, by the way, and resettled in other third-party countries, as you mentioned. Is the normal way of dealing with refugees. Now, these two organizations, the UN High Commission and UNRWA, have two definitions of who is a refugee and different mandates for dealing with refugees. According to the High Commission definition of a refugee, the number of refugees decreases over time. According to the UNRWA definition, the number of refugees increases over time, in fact, balloons over time, because it's handed down over the generations. In most other cases, the refugee status is not hereditary. So you have a difference in the definition. Then you have the difference in the mandate. The High Commission mandate allows for the resettlement, permanent resettlement, of refugees in third-party countries, not necessarily their home country or country of origin. The UNRWA definition only allows for taking care of the humanitarian needs. So if you take the UNRWA definition, which by definition creates an expanding population, and the UNRWA mandate, which allows you only to take care of humanitarian needs and not find permanent solutions, you're quickly forced to the conclusion that UNRWA is an organization that perpetuates the problem that it's supposed to solve. And this is what has happened. You know, people have calculated that if the universal definition of refugees was applied to the Palestinian situation, the number of refugees would shrink from around about 5 million today to somewhere around 50,000. So this is a dramatic disproportion. And one of the things that Israel should be pushing for and is not is that the Palestinian refugee situation should be dealt with in accordance with international norms, which would basically eliminate the problem.
Exactly, exactly. Thank you for explaining that, because that's a huge part of this that many people don't understand, and that does clarify it very well. I wanted to bring up just another point that I just noticed recently, and it has to do with the Temple Mount and Hamas, okay? I wrote an article I write for Israeli Cool. I write blogs, and I wrote a blog for Israeli Cool, and I called it Bonfire of the Damned. And the reason why I wrote that, I called it that and wrote that is because Hamas recently blew up a bus in Israel, in Jerusalem, okay, with a suicide bomber. Hamas did this. Hamas is supposed to be in Gaza, but this guy, this Hamas guy, was in Judea and Samaria and came into Jerusalem, blew up this bus. And Hamas had a party celebrating the blowing up of this bus. The only one who died was the bomber who blew his legs off and died in an Israeli hospital a couple days later. And another side note, Hamas had done a music video, an actual music video with the guys dancing around a bus, and they were going to, you know, burn Jewish flesh, and they were all happy about this. And then they eventually, you know, made good on their, on what they were going to do. Only thank the Lord that no Israelis died. People were hurt, but nobody died except the guy who blew off his legs and died, the bomber. Okay. Now at this party, They did up an exact replica of this blown up bus with the blown up, the firing, you know, the fire, the right down to the lettering on the license plate, the number of the bus, which I think was number 12. And now, Dr. Sherman, behind the bus as a backdrop was the Dome of the Rock on the Temple Mount. So when they try to say, well, it's Jordanian and it's, you know, Jordan, the Waqf has jurisdiction over the Temple Mount, and then Fatah is involved in, you know, this part of Jerusalem, and Hamas is over here, so we separate the good terrorists from the bad terrorists. And really, Dr. Sherman, isn't it all just amalgamated together when you think of that entire situation that I just described and the Temple Mount, as you've just listed in your article, that, you know, Abbas said they better keep their smelly feet. Like, this whole thing, you don't have to be a genius to see this is a religious war against the Jews, and it's a sovereignty. It's to be superior over the Jews on the Temple Mount, because we all know the Temple Mount is where the two Jewish temples stood, and this is the most important place, the most holiest place for the Jews. What do you say to what I just said?
Well, I think your analysis is basically correct. I don't think that there's any real difference in the kind of animosity that the different Palestinian factions have for Israel. And I think it's a grave mistake on the part of Israel to try and portray Fatah as the more pragmatic and moderate, and Hamas is the more radical and hostile. I think that's a mistake. I think that the whole Palestinian Arab collective, together with the rest of the Arab world, are just as hostile towards any idea of Jewish sovereignty. You know, they may situations be more pliant and more cunning and less abrasive, as you can see now with some of the Gulf states and Saudi Arabia, but because they're facing the common threat of Iran. But you know, today the so-called moderate Saudis don't allow Jews into the country. They certainly don't allow Israelis into the country. I think it would be a mistake to try and identify pockets of moderation, sincere moderation, in facing the threat. I think we're going to be very, very vigilant and very assertive and very robust. Unfortunately, many of the elites here have a much more pliant attitude and trying to interpret all sorts of nuances as a new reality dawning. But I think they're fooling themselves.
Yes, I do too. Because, you know, as we can see this with the global Islamic Jihad rising around the world in response, I believe, to the weakness of the West, we can see that this is more than likely going to get worse. It's not going to get better in the sight of any kind of weakness, weakness in Israel or weakness in the West. And this brings me to another heading you have in your article. It's called Perilous Parallels. What do you mean by that?
Well, you know, when people look at the seemingly intractable conflicts between Israel and the Arabs, they seem to take comfort in other conflicts that seemed also to be intractable and were eventually resolved. Like, for instance, the war with Germany, the World War with Germany, or the war with Japan. But there is a qualitative difference between those situations and the one that we're witnessing here in the Middle East. The first difference is that both Germany and Japan signed a surrender agreement unconditionally. They actually admitted that they'd been beaten and surrendered to the victors. This is something that's never really happened in Israel. Even in the Six-Day War, the Arabs were never forced to sign a document of surrender to admit that they'd lost. And so they keep finding all sorts of configurations to carry on the hostility. But I think the most important thing is the difference in the geophysical conditions that prevailed then and that prevail in the Middle East. Germany wasn't surrounded by a swathe of Teutonic nations that kept sending in radicals to undermine the stability and to undermine any peace agreement that the victors may want to conclude with some amenable local regime. The same thing, Japan wasn't surrounded by swathes of Nipponic nations that kept sending in radicals to destabilize and undermine any possible peace movement. But here in the Middle East, you do have that. You have swathes of Islamic and Arab countries surrounding the Palestinians, surrounding the other nations. And in those nations, you have huge sectors that are very destabilizing, very radical, and who can undermine any agreement that you may have with so-called moderates. You know, you don't have to look further than, say, Lebanon and Gaza. In Lebanon, after the Lebanese War, the first Lebanese War, when Israel reached Beirut and Bashir Gemayel took over, he was killed apparently by his brother. You know, because he had made a peace agreement with Israel, and the whole agreement collapsed. And you saw the same thing in Gaza, where Israel withdrew and basically handed over the control and the administration to Abbas. Within a short matter of time, Abbas was expelled and ejected from Gaza, and radical was taken over. And today the situation is even more problematic, because you have the Sinai descending into a jihadic no man's land, controlled by warlords who could easily influence what goes on in Gaza, despite the Egyptian efforts to try and control them, which haven't been so successful up to now. And you have a situation brewing in Jordan, which has been engulfed by refugees from Syria, which are probably completely infiltrated by radical elements. The country is teetering on the brink of economic disaster. And if the regime falls, or even if it stays in power but is completely dominated by a more radical regime, you could have any peace agreement with the Palestinians in Judea and Samaria completely undermined by radicals infiltrating and agitating and fermenting revolts. So I think the analogy that people try to draw between what happened between Germany and the Allies and the U.S. and Japan are completely inappropriate.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've just mentioned Hamas. We've just talked about Gaza and Hamas, and you've got another interesting line here. It says, if Hamas were disarmed, and then you go on, what do you say about that? Because that's something that many of us think about. What if...
Well, you know, during the Protective Edge campaign, the idea came up about Hamas being disarmed and having a demilitarized entity in Gaza. Yeah, which on paper sounds fine until you begin to think about it, because it's not as if that demilitarized entity with a disarmed Hamas is going to be completely free of enemies. It's obviously going to have to face armed elements who are going to try and take it over. Now, who's going to defend them?
Right.
Who's going to defend them? Is Israel supposed to defend them? So Israel is going to redeploy in Gaza to defend Hamas. Many of these proposals are so myopic that it boggles the mind. If Hamas was disarmed, then who is going to protect Hamas, and how?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And then you say here, the only way for Israel to do this to rule there in Gaza.
What I said there, people say, well, we shouldn't displace Hamas because maybe we'll get someone more radical. Well,
yeah,
that's true, but the only way Israel can determine who will rule Gaza or Judea and Samaria and who doesn't is if it rules it itself. We saw that with the disengagement. Israel pulled out. Abbas was in control of Gaza, and he lost control. The same thing with Hamas. You can leave Hamas there, but you can, especially if you disarm it, as we talked about before, how are you going to prevent more radical elements taking over from it? So the only way that Israel can prevent more radical elements taking over Gaza is by ruling Gaza itself. And the only way it can rule Gaza without being accused of ruling another people is by finding alternative locations for the other people, as I've said many times before, by funding relocation of the Gaza population and the Palestinian Arabs in Judea and Samaria in some other location out of harm's way and free from the cycles of violence. Because one thing's clear, unless you do that, they're going to be recurring cycles of violence. We've seen it time and time again. We've already had three or four rounds in Gaza. We've had recurring violence in Judea and Samaria. At the moment the IDF pulls out of there, you'll have a mega Gaza on the fringes of Greater Tel Aviv. And again, it's a difficult situation for Israel, but it's a much worse situation for the Palestinians. So if anyone thinks relocating Palestinians with generous financing is a harsh proposal, they should have a hard look at what the alternative proposal has provided the Palestinians. Just cycle off the cycle of death and destruction. Now, you may have good intentions and you want to set up a Palestinian state living in peace and harmony and prosperity with Israel, but that doesn't look like it's going to happen. What looks like it's going to happen if you keep persisting with a two-state formula is recurring death and destruction.
Yes, yes, absolutely. That's exactly what it looks like. And, we can see it happening around the world. There are parts of London and parts of France and parts of Sweden and Germany where jihadists have taken over parts of these areas, and the indigenous population, the police and whatever, can't get in there. So you've got sort of de facto jihad little states starting all over Europe. And we can see the violence. We can see all the same kinds of things that are going on in Israel. So it's not that difficult to see if you just look around the world and look at the evidence. But for some reason, so many people don't want to do that, but whatever. And your next, now we're jumping into your next article because we've come to the end of the first one. And the next one is called The Political Algorithms of the Arab-Israeli Conflict. Now you do go on with ideas from your first article and include ideas in this that are, that answer some of your questions. So let's jump into this one. Let's see here. You've got, well, you put in a definition of algorithm, a detailed sequence of actions to perform to accomplish some task, a precise rule or set of rules specifying how to solve some problem from Webster's Online Dictionary. And then you've got political realism believes that politics is governed by objective laws that have their roots in human nature, the operation of these laws being impervious to our preferences. Men will challenge them only at the risk of failure. And that's by Hans Morgenthau, Principles of Political Realism. So I'm just going to say one more thing and then I'll let you speak. So last week, in a very simple conflict, Dr. Martin Sherman pointed out that arguably the most widely propagated and misleading falsehoods regarding the Arab-Israeli conflict in general and the Palestinian-Israeli one in particular is that it is immensely complex and complicated problem requiring great sophistication and creativity to resolve. The corollary of simplicity. And he argued that, in fact, quite the opposite was true, but cautioned that recognition of the conflict's stark simplicity does not in any way imply that it is easy to resolve. Rather, it is precisely its brutal simplicity that makes it so intractable and a solution so elusive. So that's the beginning. Now, just go into this for us, Dr. Martin Sherman, what you were saying in this article here.
Okay, well, what I'm saying in the article is that if your point of departure is that Israel should continue to endure as a nation state, as a Jewish people, it has to contend effectively with two imperatives.
Mm-hmm.
One imperative is the geographic imperative, and the other imperative is the demographic imperative.
Mm-hmm.
And this is almost axiomatic because unless Israel is tenable geographically, and tenable demographically, it will not endure as a nation state of the Jewish people because it will be either untenable geographically or untenable demographically.
Right.
That sort of seems almost axiomatic. Now, if you look at what Israel would require to address effectively its geographic imperative, that in itself almost makes a Palestinian state impossible. I think perhaps one of the most authoritative studies of Israel's security requirements was a study done several years ago at the Jerusalem Center for Public Affairs,
mm-hmm.
which was authored by an impressive array of former IDF generals and senior politicians. And they came to the conclusion that at the very minimum, Israel needs to control the eastern slopes of the highlands in Judea and Samaria on the West Bank in order
mm-hmm.
to protect the western slopes of the highlands to protect the heavily populated coastal plain. It
mm-hmm.
needs to control the eastern slopes of the highlands down to the Jordan Valley to ensure
mm-hmm.
against some kind of territorial invasion from the east. And
mm-hmm.
it needs to control the airspace and the electromagnetic spectrum above this territory. Now, if that's what Israel needs with minimum security, in other words, to address the geographic imperative, there is really no room to set up a Palestinian state. It would just be territorially impossible to find some kind of geographic configuration that would allow a Palestinian state. Now, if you assume or accept the legitimacy of the Palestinian narrative, in other words, that the Palestinians are an authentic national entity, then you must accept also the legitimacy of all the aspirations that flow from that narrative, like, for instance, statehood. But if a Palestinian state is legitimate, then anything that prevents the establishment of a Palestinian state cannot be legitimate, because it prevents a legitimate Palestinian state. Now, if Israeli security requirements are such that they prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, then those requirements must be delegitimized. So if you want to legitimize Israel's minimum security requirements, the only way to do that is by delegitimizing the Palestinian narrative, because if the Palestinian narrative is legitimate, Israeli security requirements are not. It's
right.
Almost mathematical logic. That's why I called it an algorithm. And there's no way to get around that. And therefore, it is only by delegitimizing the Palestinian narrative, in other words, undermining, discrediting, disproving the Palestinian claim that they are indeed an authentic and separate nationalized identity, that you can regain the possibility of re-legitimizing the Zionist narrative and preserving Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people. It's almost an inevitable chain of logic. Now, of course,
it's what they call a no-brainer.
Now, of course, the problem is, if you accept that, then you are confronted with a demographic imperative, because then what do you do with the Arab population in the territories that you need to control? Now, my contention is that even if the optimistic demographers are correct, and they probably are, you will still be left with a Muslim minority of anywhere between 30% to 40%. Now, if you're going to consider that population the permanent population, which eventually will need some kind of enfranchisement and some sort of path to citizenship and voting rights, then you will not be able to maintain a Jewish state, because you will not be able to maintain the Jewish character of the state, the flag, the anthem, the calendar, the conduct of public ceremonies, the use of Hebrew as the means of communication, a major means of communication, etc., etc. You won't be able to preserve that situation if you have a non-Jewish minority of 30% to 40%, which not only does not accept the Jewish character of the state, but rejects it vehemently. And therefore, if your point of departure is that Israel should be the nation state of the Jewish people, and you need the territory, you have to diminish the Arab or non-Jewish presence inside those frontiers. And the only non-violent way of doing that is by encouraging immigration, by economic inducements, by increasing the incentives for leaving and increasing the disincentives for staying. You know, people might find this difficult to swallow at the beginning, but there's, you can't fit square pegs into round holes. If your point of departure is that Israel should endure as the nation state of the Jewish people, then you need the territory to secure it, and you have to get rid of the non-Jewish recalcitrant population. And the only way of doing that non-violently is by, as I say, by encouraging Arab immigration through economic inducements. And I think this is a proposal that has clear moral superiority over the two-state solution, which involves the setting up of a homophobic, misogynistic, Muslim majority tyranny on the very fringes of Israel's most populated area, which will become a bastion for jihadi terror sooner or later. I can't understand why people see that as a more moral proposal than offering non-belligerent Palestinians the chance of building a better life for themselves elsewhere, out of harm's way, and free from the clutches of the cruel and corrupt cliques who've led them astray for decades and brought them nothing but, as I said, recurring circles of violence and death.
Yes, yes. I agree. I've heard you speak a few times in person, and then I've read your articles, and this, if one takes the time to think the whole thing through and read your words, it makes total sense, and it is a humanitarian option. It gives the people, the so-called the Palestinian Arabs, a chance at a new life. You know, if it is so terrible under the so-called occupation, then why wouldn't they want to go somewhere where they would have a better life? And, you know, it just makes complete sense. But the psychological and the religious brainwashing is so strong on these people to hate the Jewish people and the Jewish state. It's really quite sad. End of this article you've written here. In an article you published in Ynet, March the 6th of 2011, you said, "I wrote of the need to delegitimize the Palestinian narrative. This, of course, is easier said than done, for rolling back the accumulated decades of distortion, deception, and delusion that have become entrenched in the collective international consciousness will be a Herculean task. But the immense scale of the task cannot diminish the imperative of its implementation." And sadly, you say, "Sadly, my call to action went unheeded." And then so you say, "Next week, subject to breaking events, I will address how this Herculean task ought to be approached." And I can't wait. I'm looking really forward to that one, Dr. Martin Sherman, because, wow, it's a huge task you've undertaken to continually write about this and try to educate people, because as I watch, and I've said it many times, things just seem to get worse and worse, and the Israeli leadership just doesn't seem to want to listen to reasonable objectives, and although I really, as an outsider, I don't like to criticize them, but I'm so concerned for the Jewish people and the Jewish homeland right now. I'm very, very concerned. So that's why I like to have you. I love to have you on and to discuss all this. And we're coming up to, we've been talking for about 45 minutes. Do you have anything else you'd like to say, Dr. Martin Sherman?
No, I think we've covered most of the points. If there are any new events, I'm sure we can always devote another program to it.
We will, so for sure. Yeah, definitely. I love having you on. I'm so happy that you agreed to it, because it's just, I really learned so much. It's just amazing. And wow, thank you so much for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
Okay, so we'll probably talk again in like 3 weeks, or, you know, just see how things go. And I'm just thrilled to have you, and just keep plugging away at all this, because you're doing a fantastic job for all of us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you, Dr. Martin Sherman. We'll see you next time.
All right, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Bye.